Ice cold beer!
Popcorn, peanuts, Cracker Jack.
I know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go and buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box?
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
To the ball game, take me out to the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. We'll root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 1, 2, 3 strikes you out at the old ball game.
All right, good morning and welcome back to the Bench Jockeys here on 101.5 UMFM. I'm Michael Elves, joined in the dugout by my pal, Brian Svensson.
What's up? What's happening?
It is a bit of a breezy, blustery day today.
Not a good baseball day.
Not necessarily a good baseball day. It's like a good practice day.
Yeah, good practice day.
Go down into the weight room.
Perfect day to run some poles.
That said, it's a great day to talk baseball. It's always a great day to talk baseball.
Of course
it
is.
I know you want to start by tipping your cap. We like to either pour one out if something bad goes down or tip our cap if something deserves acknowledgement or praise.
I want to tip my cap to Javi Baez, who walked for the first time in 183 at-bats yesterday.
That is a good one to start with.
That's crazy. How can you not walk in 182 previous at-bats? That's just tipping my cap to maybe the improving plate discipline of Javi Baez.
Yeah, that's an impressive feat, really, considering,
yeah,
you know,
he's such a wonderful baseball player, too. He's got such a smooth swing. He is athletic. He is fast. He is everything that you want in a baseball player, except he swings at everything.
That's it. I can't fault someone. I mean, that's my inclination is, you know, watching guys who, you know, there are obviously guys with great eyes who just sit and wait for their pitch. But it's always just kind of dispiriting to watch guys take a called strike on a hittable ball. And so I appreciate seeing guys who are like, I'm just gonna take my swings and try.
That's fair.
I come from that mentality too, right? I think I'd rather strike out swinging than get a called strike.
I mean, yeah, I'd rather. The thing is though is that like I'm such a huge fan of the Scott Hatterberg approach that like always take the first pitch and make the pitcher throw strikes. So, I don't know.
I get, like, you know, on any statistical and sort of, you know, quant level that you should take the first pitch, but I like to jump on it.
That's fair.
Because it's like, otherwise it's a free strike a lot of the time, right?
I still got to put it in the zone.
Pitches, I mean, they have to put it in the zone, but, like, that's their first and best chance to do so.
Yeah.
And especially if they think you're not going to hit it.
Yeah. Maybe.
I don't know. This is a
still,
you
know, tipping my cap to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's great. And it's kind of funny because I was listening to, I guess it was either Three Swings or the MLB The Ringer podcast. Those are the two I kind of listened to the most. Talking about Mike Trout and that period about a month ago when he was going through like a hitless streak.
Right.
And they're like, even during that period, his on-base percentage was still in like
340,
the 300s,
I think it was, yeah.
Because he was getting walks.
Yeah.
Right. So
insanity.
Even when he couldn't connect with the ball, he was still walking. Whereas like Javi Baez, like
his OBP
the fact
was
that
still
he could
like
do that, yeah, during a completely hitless streak versus Javi Baez, who 182.
Yeah, so this was the 183rd at-bat. Yeah, Mike, if I remember correctly, Mike Trout went 0-for-25 over a span, and his OBP was still 342, which is still an above-average on-base percentage.
Yeah, it's still, like, elite level,
yeah,
you know, plus war.
Yep. Just by walking. Didn't get a hit in 20, 25 at-bats. Now, granted, like, that's not including, because walks aren't an at-bat. They're a plate appearance or whatever. But.
Right, and this is the thing, right? It hurts the batting average, but it helps the OBP. Baez also involved in kind of a weird situation this week. I don't know if you saw the contested slide that Madden... there were two in the Cubs-Pirates series, one-in-one game.
So Rizzo was the first offender.
Yeah, and so one of it was Cubs on Pirates.
Right.
Second one was Pirates on Cubs. Baez didn't end up throwing from second to first.
Right. So Rizzo slid on Francisco Cervelli. And I saw the slide, and I didn't like it. He is on the mound side of home plate, feet first, taking out Cervelli's ankles. And Cervelli has no idea it's coming. And that's a no-no. You don't do that.
I mean, this goes back. How many years ago did Buster Posey get his leg broken that they started kind of changing the, like...
The I want to say it was around 2008 or 2009.
I mean, that was obviously charging the plate, but in terms of the, like, protecting the catcher...
Right. I want to say it was around 2008 or 2009.
Yeah, so we're almost a decade into that.
Exactly. And then the other one was... I can't remember the Pirates player who slid.
It was the pitcher, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And I have less of a problem with that because he was attempting to break up a double play, and Baez saw it coming. Right? So he had time to protect himself, which he kind of did.
It was Joe Musgrove.
Yeah, it was Musgrove. That's right. And so, like, I have less of a problem with it, but at the same time, like... Don't try and injure people. That's just my stance on the whole thing, is you just shouldn't try and injure people. And that the league should be there to try and protect players from other guys doing that sort of nonsense. They did that a couple years ago with the Dodgers, right? In the...
It was the Chase Utley.
The Chase Utley slide. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously that one was in the playoffs, so the stakes were much higher than a early season... series
right.
between the Pirates and the Cubs, but I think the intention behind things is what's being judged, right? And obviously, so Madden, I just pulled it up just now by just kind of searching like Baez Madden slide controversy,
right.
And so the first result that came up was ABC7 Chicago and Jesse Rogers piece, but I'm pretty sure I saw it somewhere else online earlier this week, but that Madden was being a bit sarcastic when he questioned about, you know, the application of slide rules. And in part, he said, you know, that's a New York play right there. I mean, obviously, he's, you know, and they quote him, and the editorializing of the writer is Madden said sarcastically after
yeah.
the quote marks. But that, you know, part of the problem is, so Madden, Baez didn't make the throw, right? So he was going to throw to first for a double play when Musgrove slid into the base and then popped back up and into Javi Baez, thus kind of like breaking up that double play. And by doing so, with Baez not making an attempt, according to the rules as they stand right now, it can't be contested. The ruling on the field, it's only, you know, if it was broken up, but he like threw to first and it went wild or something like that.
Then they could contest it.
Then they could contest it. But because there was no attempt at a play.
Which is like, he was just trying to protect himself, right? Like,
yeah.
if you watch it, the reason why he doesn't make the throw is because he's trying to protect himself. I agree that they should probably make it so that way that they can contest them even if the guy doesn't throw it. But I still have a problem with it, but less of a problem because it felt less dangerous than the Rizzo slide did.
Yeah, and I don't think, like, looking back to the Utley one, like, that one was a dangerous play, too.
Oh, absolutely.
The intent was there, whereas Musgrove, I think, I mean, first of all, it's a pitcher.
Who probably doesn't really understand how to slide.
Like, how often does he, like, practice this?
No.
You know, that's not really, like, I mean, there's PFP. Like, they're learning how to, like, field a ball, but there is not a lot of, like,
not
know,
a lot of
breaking
batting practice,
up a double play.
New
practice. I doubt that's something they spend any time on in Florida or Arizona in the spring league either.
No.
It was Elias Diaz, the catcher, not Francisco Cervelli.
Sorry,
at the plate. But
my bad.
I just happened to see that in this Jesse Rogers piece.
Musgrove slide reminded me a lot of the Jose Bautista slide that got him punched in the mouth by Rougned Odor. It was very similar. And I didn't have any problem with Batista's slide. Surprise, surprise, I'm a Jays fan. But, yeah, I didn't really have much problem with Musgrove's slide. Rizzo's slide was bad. Was really bad. But Musgrove's slide was kind of whatever.
And even Baez says it was kind of a non-starter. He said he went hard. I'm not saying it was a bad slide. But I asked him what was that about, and he said sorry, and the conversation was over. But everybody came out because they have to. This is Baez being quoted as saying. And, of course, Madden, being the jovial kind of jokester guy, said, you know, we were pairing up. I was going for first base coach Kamara Bardi because I've known him for a long time. He wanted Chili Davis. I stepped in front. It was an absurd moment.
I love baseball brawls. They're the funniest, especially when the bullpen's empty and you got, like,
everyone pouring out of there.
Just jogging in from center field.
That's really when you need the bullpen cart. One of them needs to, like, hijack the bullpen
just
cart and
drive it all the way to the flight. That'd be so funny.
That would definitely make a SportsCenter highlights package, for sure.
So you had a question for me about Vladito.
So, yeah, SB Nation, Grant Brisby wrote this yesterday on SB Nation, the cost of keeping Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the minor leagues. This is the title of the piece. The argument about the Blue Jays burying a potential star because they don't want him to make too much money or leave too soon. It makes sense for them, but it doesn't make sense for Major League Baseball. And so his piece kind of builds on a history that we've had with guys like Chris Bryant being held in the minors.
Like they sent Chris Bryant down for 3 weeks.
For team control, because there's, you know, these rules around if they get called up at a certain point.
Super two dates.
And sort of the period in which they hold control.
Over arbitration.
Gets extended.
Right.
And so it keeps the cost down of that initial contract.
Right.
Not bearing in mind, obviously, any like signing bonuses that they had to do.
Right.
No, this is simply like that first contract as a ball player. So that seems to be the argument that Brisby's making. However, you come at it from a completely different angle as to why Vladdy is not up for
this. Right. And so, first of all, I want to say that, like, in terms of a lot of other players and the way that the MLB arbitration system and control time and service time work, I don't disagree with Brisby that it's I don't disagree with Brisby that it's very heavily in favor of the teams, and that majorly the MLB PA should do something about it to try and get these guys more money, because more smart, like, the teams are becoming smarter and they're less likely to pay guys for past performance. So they're going to keep these guys. They're not going to get paid their whole worth during this arbitration time. And then they're not going to get paid when they finally come out of their, like, after, they're not going to get paid in the long run because nobody's going to be wanting to pay for past performance, and everyone's going to be too afraid of a decline to pay some of these guys a lot of money. Tommy Pham is a really, really good example of this. Jose Bautista is another one, right? Where these guys aren't getting the money that they deserved for the performance that they're putting up right now because of arbitration and service time. And Chris Bryant's going to be another one that's not going to get paid. He's not going to get paid his true worth. Trey Turner was another one that got held down for that reason. The thing with Vlad, though, with the Vladito, Mr. Guerrero Jr., is that his defense is atrocious. There is a wonderful 5.5-minute video on Baseball or Prospects America on YouTube that you can find that showcases through both game time situations and during, like, infield practice, very recent Vladimir Guerrero Jr. fielding adventures, we're going to call them. His footwork is very sloppy. His transfer time from glove to hand is potentially even worse. And he rushes a lot of throws. He short arms a lot of throws. And to try and make up for accuracy problems. And overall, you would have a better chance finding major league fielding on any given slow pitch field on a Sunday. It's bad. And so, and the Jays front office has iterated this and reiterated this over and over again that he's not coming up until his defense improves. And there's really no point in bringing him up this year in a what is probably going to be a lost season for the Jays. They're already 9 games or 9 or 10 games back at the wild card spot. It was 9 as of yesterday. And so there's no point in bringing him up to flounder as a defensive third baseman, especially if you've already got Josh Donaldson, who's in and out of the lineup. And they want him to play third base every single day once he's up. And so playing him at DH isn't going to help that either. So while I do agree with Brisby that there is a problem with the way that Major League Baseball handles young players and their service time, I'm going to be more upset if they hold Vlad down next year if his defense is ready to go. But this year, his defense is just far too bad to even consider it.
So, I mean, this is a guy who just turned 19, right?
Correct.
His birthday was in March.
Yeah, he's only 19.
And, I mean, obviously he's raking. He's hitting the ball great.
Yeah.
Do you think that, like, having seen what's happened with the Braves, with Albies and Acuna and some of these other, like, 19-year-old or young guys coming up, that's fueling some of this, like, desire to see Vlad Jr. Be up already?
It's the fact that he's the number two prospect in baseball. It's the fact that he is the son of one of the best pure hitters of the 1990s. It's the fact that he himself has just as incredible of a hit tool and a power tool as his dad does, with like an even better eye. He doesn't chase pitches out of the zone like his old man used to. It's the fact that this guy could be potentially the best hitter in baseball for the better part of a decade. People are excited to see good players, and I don't blame them. But for the Jays, and for Vlad, it makes more sense for him to get better as a defensive third baseman. Otherwise, that's all he'll be, is just a bat. He needs to learn how to field.
Admittedly, he's playing for the Jays, an AL team.
Correct.
So there is the opportunity to kind of slowly kind of acclimate him to Major League fielding and give him a lot of at-bats by, you know, DHing him sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. But at the same time, like, the argument to that is that you don't get as much infield training, right? And so if you're having the roaming infield trainer in Major League Baseball for one prospect, you're also hampering the potential defensive growth of 9 or 10 other defensive other prospects that you have, right? Bo Bichette's not getting the same sort of treatment. Kavan Biggio's not getting the same sort of treatment. Rowdy Tellez not getting the same sort of treatment. Casey Clemens, you know, these guys that you're counting on as well aren't getting the same sort of looks and help from a defensive coach, because you've got him up in the major leagues helping Vlad Jr. do it. And if I'm Ross Atkins, I'm counting on at least 3 of those other prospects as well going forward. So
the one thing I took away from the I mean, I enjoyed the notion, but in terms of Brisby's article, he said right now Guerrero is relegated to ruining the days of underpaid 21-year-olds in the Eastern League. I mean, obviously he's raking at that level. The thought of like giving him some at bats at a major league level and seeing more potent pitching to truly develop, right? Because I mean, at a certain level, if you're always kicking the ass of a pitcher in the Eastern League or like in lower levels, are you going to develop as a hitter, or are you going to plateau? Are you going to, you know, kind of, it's like a big kid dunking on like 6-year-olds or something, you know, like you're not developing as a basketball player. You need to kind of face competition either at your own level or above your level to truly grow.
Yeah, and I can see that perspective. I don't think that the reason why the Jays are holding him back is because of monetary reasons, as Brisby suggests. They've said multiple times that they're more than happy to pay Vlad when it's time to pay him. I think they're just focusing on his defense, and Shapiro and Atkins are notoriously guarded with their prospects, slow with people moving through their minor league systems. This is something they did in Cleveland as well, so it doesn't necessarily surprise me. If Vlad doesn't come up next year, then I'll be upset and concerned.
True enough. Yeah, I mean, the deeper argument about, you know, like using Chris Bryant or George Springer or other guys as a
Springer's another one, yeah.
Examples of this thing, you know, his argument, yes, baseball as a whole, MLB, you know, you have 30 teams, so each guy is a drop in the bucket, but he said, you know, over time, the accumulation of these drips, it adds up to we're not seeing the best players.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily...
Because of, you know, like 7 years down the line money. And if you're trying to attract or keep young viewership or crowds to the park and stuff, you want to have superstars playing, right? Like, you want your most exciting and dynamic and young players that appeal to that younger generation to be on the field, right? Like, we've talked about this in terms of, like, the difference between the NBA and MLB in terms of the attracting youth is kind of the personality-driven stuff. And these young guys, if I'm a 12-year-old boy playing baseball, and I know that, like, there's a guy who's 7 years older than me who is, like, now on the Blue Jays, like, that's super exciting to me to have
that's
guy
a good point.
To look at.
That's a good point. I don't necessarily mind that argument. I think it's mostly fine. It's a good point. I would just, yeah. Yeah, okay. I can see that. That's fair.
And this is something, like, baseball has shot itself in the foot over and over when it comes to stuff like CBA stuff. And I mean, I think back, I read a really fantastic book a few years back called Well Paid Slave that was about Kurt Flood and his battle for free agency. And, you know, this, like, attempt to control these players in a very monopolistic way and not allow them to, like, realize their potential or, you know, achieve their kind of, like, maximum income. It's this cabal behavior that really doesn't benefit either the players or the crowds. The only people it benefits are the 30, like, rich white dudes in that room in New York.
Correct. I wish they got paid more money is the thing, right? And I've been an advocate for minor league players getting paid more money. I used to work for the Goldeyes. I've seen all there's an Instagram post that's specifically about how dudes live in minor league baseball, and it is appalling. And so I want guys in minor league baseball to get paid more money. I want younger players to get paid more money in the major leagues. This isn't what that's about. I always want the players to get paid more money. I also don't like the idea of teams not having control over their prospects at the same time too, because then everyone just goes to the Yankees and the Dodgers.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There was a great book. Man, it was a relief pitcher who ended. Guy who wrote the Bullpen Gospels. So, guy who played for Harvard, I think. Dirk Hayhurst.
Okay.
Has written a couple books, and one of them was about his time in the minor leagues. And yeah, like, it's
appalling.
It's
five dudes living in a one bedroom apartment with cots on the ground. It's you know, five dudes cramming into, like, a Toyota Corolla to get to their next game, taking their microwave and three jars of peanut butter with them.
I was going to say, like, peanut butter and bread, and then, like, grabbing as much food as they can from the tables in the locker rooms, like,
yeah,
you know, apples and bananas, and taking them home.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's peak guys that are supposed to be peak athletes that have atrocious diets, atrocious sleeping habits, atrocious sleeping conditions. You know, these are supposed to be high performance athletes, and they're treated like garbage by their own organizations because, yeah, 30 rich white dudes just don't want to lose out on what, like, $6 million, I think, is what Ben Lindbergh from The Ringer said would cost for each team to properly pay their minor league players like human beings.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
When you consider what it would be as a percentage of, like, the overall budget for some of these major league clubs, it's ridiculous.
And the worst part is that they're already kind of paying for this stuff, right? So the argument towards paying players more is that it costs, on average, on the free market, $10 million for a single win above replacement. And if you paid your minor league teams, like, if you put that $10 million into paying your minor league players, every single guy in your minor league system would get paid at least $60,000. And you're bound to get more than a single win above replacement out of that return. You know, even if it's just one guy that doesn't drop out because of how awful the life is, or one guy that is able to maximize his performance because he is able to sleep and eat better. It's just astounding to me that nobody has done this yet.
When you think about the improvements that the clubs have made at the major league level in terms of, you know, the chartered jets, the leg room, opportunities for sleep, the like sports psychologists that they use, the like nutrition experts that are in the clubhouse, like attention to diet and stuff like that. It's like these people don't exist within the system until they get to that locker room at the major league level. But it's like these guys, if you develop them with those habits, it's, you have to imagine the, like,
way better,
the return on investment of that would be so much higher.
Yeah. And yeah, some of these guys, some of these kids, most of these kids in the minor league systems aren't going to make it, and so some of it's a lost investment, but who cares? You have an insane amount of money. A lot of these owners have way too much money, more money than they know what to do with.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you're just improving the lives of 250 people, just straight up.
Yeah.
And you're improving your chances at finding that superstar in your minor league system. It's baffling to me. I can't stand it.
Well, speaking of being baffled, Carlos Gomez this week, baffled by the supposed random nature of random drug testing. He was with Jeff Passan, Tim Brown, and Mike Oz on the Yahoo Sports MLB podcast this week, talking about the way the league drug tests players, and specifically the players they're testing and how often they do it. This coming on the heels of Robbie Cano's 80-game suspension, he talked about feeling targeted by MLB drug tests, and specified that, you know, it does not seem random. He says, the quote, "They pick guys. I think it's something, the way you play, the way you act. I'm the oldest guy on the team. I get here earlier than everybody. Why? Because I have to work harder to maintain my body to support the rest of the season. When I do that and they come to you and have a drug test, every time you get furious, you get mad. 1 month into the season, I got like 7 drug tests." And this is following on the heels of Eric Thames last year, who obviously had come back from Japan and had like 13 homers in his first month back in the major leagues for the Brewers.
And Thames claims he was tested 31 times last season. 31.
Yeah.
And there was a Players Tribune article that was a Q&A with David Ortiz, where he claimed that he had been tested 80 times in between 2004 and 2015. And so Gomez himself is claiming that it's older dudes and Latin players, and he happens to fall in the category of both of those.
Yeah. That Venn diagram is a circle.
Yeah. And
as is Robbie Cano.
Yep. And Nelly Cruz has claimed that he's been tested a whole bunch of times, too. David Ortiz would have fallen into that in the later part of his career.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't... If these guys are claiming that they're getting tested a whole bunch, you know, I don't really understand why a lot of these guys would have incentive to lie about it.
Yeah, this is random the way, like, TSA checks are random.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
There's some selective screening going on.
I've never been screened ever at an airport. I fly fairly regularly. Never once been screened at an airport. I'm a tall, skinny white dude with glasses, and I've never been screened. And I agree with you. It's bad, and obviously the MLB is not going to investigate themselves on this matter, but it's. The more guys that come out about this, and I hope more guys do, the more embarrassing it looks to the league if there's a racial profile to it.
Yeah, so TBO.com, this is Mark Topkin from yesterday. Major League Baseball sticking to its story, telling the Tampa Bay Times players are selected randomly. "Our joint drug program, which is negotiated with the Players Association, is independently administered and has random testing procedures in place with no regard for a player's birthplace, age, or any other factor. Every aspect of the test selection process is randomized and identified, and every player is included each time random selection is conducted." So if it was truly random, there is no way on earth Eric Thames should have been tested over 30 times last year.
Nope.
There are how many baseball players in the major leagues? If every person gets thrown back into the pot in terms of testing to be randomized, the odds of him coming up 30 times like
so catastrophically small. There's what 30 teams times 25. We'll round it up to 30 players over the course of the season. That's 900 players. So
a 1 in 900 chance
that you get tested.
Or let's say they test 10 people at a time or something, right? So it's like,
yeah, 10 people a week. We'll just claim, or even 10 people a day. Like the odds of you coming up that many times is still ridiculous. And didn't
Gomez said he was tested for either the 6th or 7th time in the first 9 weeks of this season?
That's absurd. That's not random. That's not random. There's no way, unless he doesn't get tested at all throughout the rest of the season. The odds of that happening are so low, so low.
Yeah, I'd start talking to like guys like Trout and Tommy Pham and say like, how often are you getting tested?
I could see Pham getting tested.
I'd love to see like the Ringer, who you know have just shown their mettle in terms of investigative journalism with the Brian Colangelo stuff.
They had a really good piece about the baseballs too.
Turn to baseball. Yeah, that's right. They did about why baseballs are hoppier right now. But yeah, turn that attention to the supposed nature of random testing and just ask.
When was the last time you were tested?
How often? Last year. We'll take last year. How often were you tested last year, right?
And ask then, the Bryce Harpers and the Mike Trouts and the Trevor Bowers. And because, Bauer would be a great person to ask because he'll be open and completely open about everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And just you know, I would love to see the numbers because I don't think the numbers bear out randomized.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound like it.
I don't think it'll hold true to that.
This is crazy.
So let's go from complaints off the field to acclaim on the field. Certainly, lots of great action within the past little while on the diamond. As much as it depressed me to notice this, that Detroit has now moved past Minnesota to take second place in the AL Central. But
so. Just some unluckiness from the Twins there. And
on top, yeah.
In their past two games, they were down by...
They were down 8-0 yesterday, I believe.
So in their two games, they were down 9-0 and scored 8 unanswered and still lost. And then yesterday, they were down 8-0 and scored 8 unanswered and still lost.
Yeah. No, that's a rough one. Boston and New York still atop. But Tampa Bay, and this is interesting because this is... You know, coming on the heels of what we talked about last week with the experiments with the
Sergio Romo,
the opener, closer, and playing with their bullpen, they continue to win with this. Like they did this multiple times over the last weekend and during this week. I mean, it makes it just really hard to roster any reliever or starter on Tampa Bay if you play fantasy at all, because you know there's no clue. The only person who knows is the bullpen coach and the manager right now as to like who's going to get the call for when, but it's working.
Yeah,
you know, this is a team that had been scuffling and have, you know, won several games over the past week and now moved into third, and you know
the Jays shooting themselves in the foot might help
into the wild
too.
Card position. Yeah. The Jays haven't certainly helped matters.
How many games back are they of the
Bay
wild card?
They had to win some games as well.
True.
Right?
How many games are they back of the wild card? It has to be at least.
Jays are 9 now.
Not the Jays. The Rays have
Rays
to be
are 5.5.
Yeah, I was going to say they have to be at least 4 because they're the Mariners are what 3.5 ahead of the Angels for the second wild card spot right now.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're actually 4.5 of the Angels. So the Angels not. Tampa Bay very close to the Angels in the wild card.
Which is crazy.
Right now.
If you told me that those two teams were going to have similar records at the start of the year, I probably would have laughed at you. That's ridiculous.
Right.
So, yeah.
Over on the National League side of things, Atlanta continuing to hold this little lead against the
Newcomb
Nationals.
Looked incredible last night against the Natties. He went 7 innings, only struck out 2, but only gave up, I think, 3 or 4 hits.
And a Medexian performance.
Yeah, only walked one guy. Control. So he looked really, really good last night. Yeah.
Yeah, and Milwaukee still 4 games ahead of the Cubs in the Central. And Colorado a game and a half up on Arizona, who have struggled a little in the last week.
Ever since A.J. Pollock went down, they've been not so great.
Yeah, no. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk some fish and fantasy here on the Bench Jockeys.
Time now for the 7th inning stretch. text. And I don't even care if we ever get back. And it's a row, row, row for the home team. And if they don't win, it's a shame. And it's one and it's two and it's three strikes, you're out. That's that old ball game. Take me out to that Twins game. Take me out to that dome. Hey, Minneapolis. Hey, St. Paul. We don't even care when we don't get the call. Cause it's row, row, row for the Minnesota Twins. And it's always a shame when the Twins don't win. And it's one and it's two and it's three strikes, you're out of that Twins ball game.
Degrees Restaurant on Campus is a true supporter of community radio. Their organic, fair trade green bean coffee fuels UMFM. And they're the top pick among UMFM DJs for food before a show. Degrees provides quality food and excellent service at a reasonable price. Check out their environmentally and socially conscious menu for both healthy bites and diner faves. Degrees Restaurant on the third floor of University Center. Summer hours are Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Part of the new breed of jazz artists embracing hip-hop and post-bop equally, trumpeter Marquise Hill brings his heavy-hitting ensemble to the West End Cultural Center on Sunday, June 17th, as part of the 2018 TD Winnipeg International Jazz Festival. Get in on the groove by purchasing your advance tickets now for only $25 and $30 plus fees at Ticketfly.com. And catch the Thelonious Trumpet competition-winning Marquise Hill and his Black Tet live at the West End Cultural Center on Sunday, June 17th, as they make their TD Winnipeg International Jazz Festival debut. Proudly presented by 101.5 UMFM.
It's June 1st and festival season starts basically this weekend. Prairie Wind Festival going on tomorrow. Actually, I guess it starts tonight, technically. And then, of course, Jazz Fest coming up. Folk Fest not far behind it. Lots of great festivals coming up. It's also baseball time in the city.
That it is.
As we mentioned last week, things opened at Shaw Park last Friday. And we like to do ballpark reports for when folks go to new ballparks. In this case, Shaw Park's not new, but there is a new feature at Shaw Park. And Brian, you managed to go test the new craft beer section.
Yeah, so I went to a ball game on the weekend with my girlfriend, and she went to the craft beer section. I went along with her. She was the one that purchased the alcohol. And not that I'm not legally allowed to, because I am, in
fact.
The
way you phrased that made it sound like you were trying to distance yourself from the purchase of alcohol or something.
Yep. So I don't know. It was pretty good. It was a pretty cool place. They've got some umbrellas and some taps and some nice stools that you can look over the field with. So that was wicked cool. Overall, I think it's a really nice feature. It looks kind of funny if you're sitting on the other side and looking at it. It looks kind of weird, but all in all, I think it's a really cool feature.
In terms of footprint, how big of a space did it take away from the A and B sections?
It's big.
Yeah?
Oh, it's really big.
Because I saw pictures of it on Instagram. I've yet to get to a game, unfortunately, just because of my wife's work schedule last weekend didn't really lend itself to taking four children to the ball game. There's like a full deck, it seems like, you know, multiple.
It's huge.
Tables and then kind of like the Green Monster, there's that like strip along the front.
Yes. And they have it's just this craft beer corner, and like what I assume is either a paint or like a vinyl or something like that. And it's very, it takes up a lot of space in sections A and B. And not only that, but like it's very difficult to get to it. I know it's 10 rows from each section, It's not difficult to get to the craft beer section. If you are seated in section A or B, you have to go down through section, like the ramp at the top of section C. And then, so if you're sitting at like, if you're sitting row one.
Far end of A.
Yeah, if you're sitting row one, seat 20 of A, you've got to go all the way down and across two
furthest
sections.
Furthest along the third baseline.
You've got to go two sections down. Not that anybody's sitting there most of the time, but if you got stuck sitting there, that's a jaunt.
That's, yeah. That's unfortunate. So yeah, you saw one game on Sunday, and then yesterday.
Yeah, I went to.
You caught the first half of the doubleheader.
Correct.
To make up for the storm stayed game the night before.
Yeah, so they played seven innings. I left in the top of the seventh because the Fish were getting hammered. When I left, it was 6-2. I don't know what the final score was in that one, but it. Kevin McGovern looked pretty good through 5 2/3. In both games, I was really disappointed with the performance of Victor Capoyan. He does not have any sort of control and has been either very walkable or very hittable to this point in this season. He's not looked great. Not really impressed.
So can I ask in terms of like, Is it a control thing? Is it he doesn't have velocity? What was your sense of?
It definitely seemed like a control thing. He the new Gold Eyes catcher Kevin Garcia, who I'm really really impressed with, by the way. He especially in the Salt Dogs game, Capoyan came and I think he either got one out or no outs, and faced five batters, and walked two of them. And Garcia had to block four or five pitches in that stretch as well. So he just has no control. There's no control over any of his pitches right now.
Yeah, so looking at, this is pointstreak.com for the box score here. So where are we here? So Capoyan. Oh, man, this is fantastic. I have to tip my cap. The fact that the winning pitcher's name was Jose.
No way.
That's that's incredible. This is the Lincoln Salt Dogs starting pitcher.
That's hilarious.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, so where are we here? Capoyan, a third of an inning, two hits, four earned runs, no strikeouts and one walk.
So yeah, he was just brutal.
Just all over the place. Then they ended up bringing in McGovern for extended relief. He pitched 5 1/3. And
I think he was starting.
Oh, was
Kevin McGovern started?
McGovern started. Okay, and so then it was Capoyan who kind of.
Yeah, well, it was McGovern first, and then Capoyan came in, and then when he blew up, then they brought in some other pitchers.
Yeah. So that game ended 8-2. And then actually, weirdly enough, the second game of the doubleheader also ended 8-2 in favor of the Lincoln Salt Dogs. That one, losing pitcher was Edwin Carl. He was the starter, and he gave up 6 through 4 innings. And then Charleston gave up 2 towards the end of the game.
I was really impressed in both games. So the game that I saw on the weekend was the Sunday day game against the Sioux Falls Canaries, which the Fish won. I was really impressed both games with new Gold Eyes catcher Kevin Garcia, who is not only hitting incredibly well, but he has been brilliant behind the plate in terms of how good he is at blocking pitches and how good he is at throwing out runners. I saw him catch 2 stealing against the Canaries, and he threw behind another one. So I guess that's 3 caught stealing, technically. And he had a couple of really, really good moments against the Salt Dogs yesterday, too. He's something special, and I don't think he's going to be on the Fish long, because with the way he's hitting and how good he is on defense, there's no way that he's not on somebody's minor league system by the end of the season.
So is it like a plus arm? Is that kind of like his best thing, or is he just kind of an all around?
It's just, he's really good at blocking pitches. Like he gets right into the dirt. No matter where the pitch is, it could be a couple feet wide. He still manages to find a way to get in front of it, and he definitely has a plus arm. His pop time is also really quick. Like, he was just up on his feet in a hurry. There was one that I saw on the game on Sunday that he threw a guy out where the guy was going right from the pitch. The ball was in the dirt, and he still managed to throw the guy out at second. So either the guy that was running was really, really, really slow, or he's just got an incredible arm. It was insane.
This is something I miss with, I mean, I've caught some of the games on the radio, and they certainly don't describe kind of where the catcher is in relation to, you know, blocking a pitch. And so I haven't had a sense of Garcia's skill as a defensive catcher yet. So I definitely want to get to a game. The Goldeyes are actually going to be on the road for the next week. They'll be back next Friday, hosting the aptly named Chicago Dogs.
I'm so excited for that.
Currently sit 1-11.
I mean, they're an expansion team. It doesn't necessarily surprise me.
It's rough.
Bark at the Park, though.
But yeah, it's the perfect time for Bark at the Park when they're hosting the Chicago Dogs.
Are you going to that? You taking your Beagle?
That's the plan. She's been before. She's enjoyed it because usually people drop popcorn or other snacks in between the chairs. And just as a bona fide Beagle, she's all about the food.
Super smart in finding that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They're moving it over a couple sections this year, right? Because of
Of the craft beer section.
Right.
Because it was AB, which now... I can only imagine how difficult it would be to move a bunch of dogs into that section.
Oh, it'd be a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it'll be, what, CD now?
I believe so, yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah, Bark at the Park coming up. And I guess you can follow the road games.
Do you get charged extra for that?
CJNU. There's like a special ticket you have to buy. And I think a portion of the proceeds goes to the Humane Society or another dog-friendly organization. So it's
wonderful.
You know, it's like a $15 ticket instead of a $12 ticket or something like that. But well worth it in the sense that, A, you get to bring your dog to the park, and B, you know that you're supporting.
That's really cool.
And usually there's like some sort of like little goodie bag for your pups as well.
Oh, so, Goldeyes dog treats.
It ends up being a wash in terms of the cost, so...
And super sweet.
Then I have a picture of myself and my dog at the ballpark.
Which is awesome.
That's all I was looking for. So let's turn our attention to the realm of fantasy here. So one of the things, like I mentioned...
Rough week for pitchers first.
Very rough week for pitchers. I do want to get into a few different pitching things. I guess I'll start with the fact that, you know, as I mentioned with this experiment going on in Tampa Bay, very hard to roster a reliever and get any kind of like predictable stats in terms of closers. And so I have been trying to find saves and hoping someone kind of moves into a secure role as a fixed closer for them. But
I think it's Alvarado right now.
Well, Pruitt also got a save over the past week as well. And I think three different pitchers ended up getting saves for the Rays over this past week.
You know, if you are hunting for saves, the closer role changed in Miami. It was officially announced last night that previous setup man Kyle Bearclaw is now the closer in Miami, as Brad Ziegler is terrible.
Yeah,
to surprise of nobody.
Ziegler with an ERA of 5.41 and a WHIP of 1.58.
Ooh, that's not good.
That is awful.
Yep.
That was the rest of season predictions. His WHIP is 1.74.
That's
right
even
now,
worse.
Which is even worse.
Oh my god.
So Bearclaw with a WHIP 103, much more in line with what you'd hope for from a decent reliever and from your saves person. The other person in line is Drew Steckenrider.
Also another good name.
Yeah, that's a great one too. Obviously not as bad as Ziegler, but not great. He's a 1.3 WHIP at the moment.
So I think they confirmed that it's going to be Bearclaw. He's going to get the opportunities, and it's his job to lose.
Yeah.
So he's, as of yesterday, he was only owned in 5.4 of ESPN leagues and 3.6 of Yahoo leagues. And so if you're struggling for saves, there's your guy right there. That's him.
The other one to consider right now is the Phillies, where Hector Neris has been abominable when handed the ball by our pal, the Quant. His ERA is 4.87 and his whip is 1.48. Not necessarily Zieglerian levels, but Sir Anthony Dominguez, and no, he hasn't been knighted by the Queen. It's Sir Anthony, S-E-R-A-N-T-H-O-N-Y.
Yep.
Dominguez, in 13.2 innings pitched, has an ERA of 0 and a whip of 0.15.
Now, I think the Kapler said that he likes him as the fireman type of role.
Yeah, and this is the thing. The Neris is certainly keeps getting offered the opportunity to blow saves.
When is Pat Neshek back?
This is a good question, because he remains... This is the real kicker with this DL-10 stint in fantasy now. It's because they can kind of keep rolling over this 10-day DL.
Right.
It used to be, you know, like a much firmer like ETA on return when they had to kind of like either do 7-day or, you know, the 30-day.
I think fantasy leagues need to adapt to this and start offering more DL availability slots for people.
These temporary DL slots. Yeah, I know. I have to keep, like, managing who's back and who's not.
In the league that we're in together, there's only 2 DL spots, and I don't think that's enough. I think most leagues need to be rolling with either 3 or 4 at this point in time.
The other guy in the lineup for Philly is Luis Garcia. All right. He has one save and one blown save in the 2 opportunities that he's had. He's mostly pitched in a setup role, ERA of 3.74, but a whip of 0.92, so decent control, and 18 strikeouts through 21 2/3 innings.
Who was that again?
That was Luis Garcia.
What about Ramos? Closer Monkey seems to think that he's part of the committee. He'll be part of the committee going forward as well.
I'm going off of Yahoo.com's latest kind of their roundup of the fantasy baseball bullpen depth chart and just kind of looking at who they list. If Ramos is on there, certainly. I mean, Neris, his hold on that job is pretty tenuous, and he has been bad in.
And the Phillies are in a spot where they could be winning games.
This is the thing. Phillies are in a spot where they can contend. And so they want to be giving the ball to someone who can close those games out for them. Looking at your Blue Jays, Ryan Tepera, obviously kind of filling in.
The Jays have been...
2 saves and 3 blown saves.
He's been not great as the closer role. I've always been a big fan of Tepera. I think he's good as a setup guy, but I just think that it's eventually going to be Sungwan Oh.
I was going to say, because Clippard also has been given an opportunity. He has 2 saves and he has 2 blown saves. So both Tepera and Clippard have struggled in the opportunities given to them. Sungwan Oh has only had 1 opportunity and did it.
And he was fairly good as a closer in St. Louis, right? So I just think it's eventually going to be him. Not that it matters. The Jays are 9 games out of the wild card spot. They've been really bad since Bobby Oh got suspended, and rightfully so. He should be suspended for a very, very long time. Placed on administrative leave. Different.
Mm-hmm.
The Jays have been very bad, and it's not just on the bullpen. Not that the bullpen's been great, but it's not just on them. A lot of bats have gone cold. Kevin Pillar's hit .156 over the last 14 days. The Jays have started 7 guys at shortstop this season. Teoscar Hernandez has cooled off. They're playing Anthony Alford, Dalton Pompey, Dwight Smith Jr. in left field to try and close some gaps. Curtis Granderson's cooled off. The bats on the Jays have just gone ice cold throughout the month of May. I don't really see it picking up anytime soon either.
So you mentioned, we'll turn our attention away from the bullpen and move to the starters and some of the starters who are scuffling. I don't know if you saw the piece yesterday that Michael Salfino wrote for Roto Arcade about pitchers to add, trade, or drop based on the story strikeout and walk numbers tell.
Oh.
But basically examining folks who seem to be underperforming or overperforming based on that strikeout and walk number. And obviously, I mean, basically we're looking at like K per nine and whip.
And whip, yeah.
Because obviously ERA, I mean, this is why we have like FIP and other things to kind of like...
ERA is such a team
downplay
stat.
Downplay ERA,
it's
right?
Such a team
there's,
stat.
There's
I mean,
defensive things that weigh into this.
And whip is starting to border on like a team stat as well, because like a pitcher really can't control hits, right? So I'm a huge fan of XFIP and Sierra and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
one of the pitchers that they... you know, highlight saying, you know, their ERA is atrocious, but there seems to be no reason why that ERA won't come down. John Gray, who has 76 strikeouts and just 19 walks in 65 innings.
Whoa.
So his strikeout minus walks over innings pitched is 0.88. ERA right now, 5.68. If you were scrolling through your, you know, watch list of available players and looking for a starting pitcher right now, and you saw an ERA of 5.68, like, you just keep scrolling.
Yep. The thing is like, ERA still is a stat that we have, that,
I mean,
that we as
fantasy
players,
depending on, I mean, maybe you're in a league where they've like, you
a
know,
super smart, super deep league that uses
moved away from ERA and they have quality starts instead of wins or something like that. But a lot of us still play in leagues with ERA, and 5.68, that's a terrible ERA that's going to hurt your ratios. But his BABIP right now is 380.
Whoa.
It's the worst in baseball.
Whoa. That's really atrocious. And that's not his fault, right? Like, that's just shading towards either bad defense or supreme unluckiness.
Yeah. The one knock on him, of course, is that he's in Colorado. And so some of that ERA is the Coors effect. And so he can't necessarily escape that. Like any starting pitcher we've seen over the years just can't quite overcome the hurdle.
You can be smart and escape that, though, by just starting him on the road.
That's the thing. Look at possible road starts. One of the other guys that they highlighted as a possible add, Vince Velasquez.
Oh, he's...
Phillies, and this is one...
owned in a lot of leagues already.
He's owned in a lot of leagues, but according to... 32% in Yahoo.
That needs to be higher.
So yeah, this is, of course, the Roto News is a Yahoo sort of subsidiary. And so, of course, they're looking at Yahoo ownership. And so 32% is pretty light. So he has, 49 strikeouts in 57 and a third. His ERA is 4.08. But yeah, he is doing worse than league average in a poor division, and he's going to get more chances to play against, you know, the Marlins for one. But they said, you know, it's another one of those things where his performance and the peripherals don't indicate that he's this bad a pitcher. And usually there's that notion of like kind of regression to the mean. And
right.
So if it's overperforming, then at a certain point it's going to blow up on you.
Right.
And if you're underperforming, at a certain point, it's going to course correct and kind of bring things back in line with kind of like what kind of pitcher you seem to be. The guys that they kind of sort of point out as problematic, Gio Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Who,
no kidding.
Who has 35 Ks minus walks in 64 and a third innings. His ERA should be about average and not 2.1.
He had this thing last year, right, where he just has a tendency of getting really, really lucky whenever there's runners on base, right? This is the exact same thing that happened with him last year. I guess at what point do you have to consider that he's just better at pitching with runners on base, right?
This is the thing, right? His well hit allowed is only 120, so he's not getting a hard hit.
Yeah. Interesting. Who else is on that list? I assume Sean Newcomb's got to be on there, too, at some point, right?
John Lester and Michael Walker are the next two on the list.
That you should get rid of.
That you should try
I mean,
to...
I rode the John Lester experiment last year, and I promised myself I'd never, ever, ever do it again. He's a guy that gets way into his own head. He can be lights out, but if he gives up two hits in the first inning, that's it. His whole entire start's shot.
The old man on base yips happen.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it for our time. We are going to have to wrap things up.
No.
I should announce next week, we're going to be moving to a half hour. We're going to be starting at 11 and running to 11:30. Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays from now until Folkfest. Festival Express is back. It's a series of introductions to artists on the bill. A variety of UMFM programmers are going to be talking to artists coming to the Folkfest. So from 11:30 to noon, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday next week, starting on Monday with Galen Lee, who won the Tiny Desk Concert contest, and Terry Stevens of Venus Envy will be talking to her Monday, 11:30, and we will be back here 11 next Friday.
See ya.
Right three, you're out.